The Greeks knew of a race of giants, and they called it Titans. These were the sons of the divine beings of Olympus, and daughters of humankind. And this myth of a race of immortals, born of gods and beautiful women, circulated throughout the ancient Middle East. It was known in West Asia. We have found that Ugarit and Alalakh, cuneiform tablets which repeat some of these legends. The legend was known to the authors of the Bible, the ancient Hebrews. There's a very interesting brief fragment about such giants, titans. They're called in Hebrew Nephilim. It appears as the first few verses of the sixth chapter of Genesis, the chapter which begins the story of Noah and the flood. And the purpose of this fragment seems to be to make clear to an ancient Israelite audience that even this group of giants, of demigods, were mortal. That immortality belongs only to God. And this is how the paragraph reads. When men began to increase on earth, and daughters were born to them, the divine beings saw how beautiful the daughters of man were, and they took as wives all whom they liked. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not shield man forever, since he is but flesh. Let the days allowed him be 120 years. It was in those days and later that Nephilim appeared on earth, after the divine beings had consorted with the daughters of man who bore them sons. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown." Now this old myth and the tradition that Moses, the great prototypical hero of our people, lived to be 120 years, is the source of that birthday greeting which we've all heard. You know, Ad Me'ab Esrim, Zuchundred and Svansig, may you live to be 120. Some weeks ago, I went to an 80th birthday party. And with all good intentions in the world, a guest came down the receiving line and turned to the honoree and said, "Until 120. And she smiled. She said, "No, thank you." And hearing this interchange, I began to think along the lines of this morning's question. Can you live too long? Young people, those who are still confident that they will never age, somehow believe innocently that life itself, brute life, raw life, is good. The more years, the more days, the more hours, somehow the greater the blessing. We don't like to hear elderly people who tend to be, I've discovered, quite forthright and honest about age. They don't like to hear them say things like this. The daughter of the 80-year-old turned to me immediately when she heard this conversation, and she said, "My mother really doesn't mean it." And mother turned to me, and she said, "I do." "There are many worse things," she said, than death. "Waking up every morning on a mattress grave that you cannot leave, dependent upon the care of others, aware that you lack the competence, the dignity, the self, the sense of self, was your pride and your life. Now the Bible tells us, if I read my Bible correctly, that it's possible to live too long. There's a time to be born, and there's a time to die. You recall that in his play, As You Like It, Shakespeare divided the generations of men, the ages of men, into seven. And he spoke of the last age as being sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything. Without teeth, without eyes, without taste, without anything. And 1,000 years before Shakespeare, those who put together the little book of the sayings of the fathers from which we read this morning divided life into 10 stages, a decade of decades. And they spoke of 60 as being the time to become an elder, 70 as the time of gray hairs, as 80 as being an age in which we need special strength, as 90 as being the age when our back is permanently bent, can't stand straight any longer, and at 100, a man is as one who is already dead. There are worse things than death. And our tradition is not one that prizes longevity, per se. One of the things that the non-Jewish world tends to assume about Judaism is that we have a unique respect for age and what we prize age uniquely. I suspect that part of this assumption about our attitude comes from the Bible, where it's clearly said that you shall respect the gray-haired and you shall rise before the elder. It comes from the recognition that in our communities, the aged were never cast off or cast out, that they were treated with sober respect, and that their financial needs were cared for within the context of the extended family. If old age is not the easiest of ages, and if it brings its own disadvantages and disabilities, one thing of which our tradition can be proud is that for its entire length, we have respected the experience which age represents. We have imposed as a commandment upon the son and upon the daughter the obligation not only to care for the aged, but to honor them, to be considerate of them. In ancient times, the sign of respect was to stand up when the king or an emperor or a sheikh came into the room. In the Talmud, we're told that the wisest of Israel, the greatest of our sages, were obliged to stand up when their parents entered their room, even if their parents were illiterate. To treat the aged with courtesy, honor, to provide for them, has been one of the commandments of the Torah, of which we as Jews have been most careful. In the 19th century, when medical science was beginning to give us the ability to prolong life for the many, up to that point in history, age was the achievement of a relative few. The aged were not a social problem in the sense of numbers as they are today. In the middle of the 19th century, men became romantic about age. Here was a new opportunity. Suddenly, the lifespan extended from, say, 40 years to now 70 years. And suddenly there were hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of people who were living beyond the 70 years and 10, and even beyond the 80 years. And interestingly, almost instinctively, they turned to the Judaic tradition, to the biblical tradition, to find the meaning of age, the vibrations which spoke honorably of age. Robert Browning wrote a poem at that time which most of us, I suspect, were set to memorizing when we were school children. He titled it Rabbi Ben Ezra. And it begins, as you all know, "Grow old with me, the best is yet to be, the last of life, for which the first was made." And it goes on to romanticize age. I'm intrigued by the fact that he turned to our tradition. I'm intrigued by the fact that the communities of 19th century Europe somehow bespoke the beauty of age and the possibility of beauty in age, which he was trying to evoke. But I do know that Robert Browning, genius poet that he was, had never met or read the poetry of Rabbi Ben Ezra. Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, 12th century, Spain, rabbinic scholar, biblical commentator, and poet. Let me read you what the real Rabbi Ben Ezra said about the stages of life. "Let but the son of earth remember from his birth that in the end he shall return, and that as at his birth he was, so he shall be. Rise and prosper, say ye to him of 5 years, whose desires rise up apace like the awakening sun on regions dim. He has his mother's breast for resting place and moves not, his father's shoulders for his chariot. Yet in the end he shall return, and at his birth he was, so shall he be. How urge ye him of 10 years with intent towards instruction? Yet a little space and he will grow and find his chastisement. Speak unto him with tender tones of grace. Joy shall he rouse for them that bear him from his father's house. For in the end he shall return as at his birth he was, so shall he be. How sweet the days of him of 20 years. Swift as a hart he leaps to and fro over the hills and scorns reproof, nor hears the voice of teachers. But a graceful doe, goodly and fair, this is the portion for him and his snare. Yet in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. At 30 years into a woman's hands he falls. Rise and look on him and see. Behold him now, caught fast within the strands. The arrows pierce him round. The wants shall be now of his life, only the wants of children and of wife. But in the end he shall return, as his birth he was, so shall he be. He wanders forth subdued, who shall attain to 40 years. He runs his way. Behind the light companions of his youth remain, and evil be it or sweet, yet shall he find joy in his lot, firm by his work, his charge forsaking not. Yet in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. The days of vanity, days nothing worth, remember he of 50 years, and mourns because the days of mourning come, and earth and all the glories of the world he scorns, bearing the fear lest his own time indeed be drawing near. For in the end he shall return, as his birth he was, so shall he be. Ask, what befalls when 60 years are his? Then have his muscles grown like root and bar set to his work, sufficing but for this, and rooted that they bend now, but so far only, and never they shall move again to rouse him to the fray. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. If into 70 years his life way wends, his words are heard no longer, 'tis his fate to go unheeded. Now upon his friends only a burden, he becomes a weight on his own soul, and on the staff that bears him to his goal. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. At 80 years, then is he but a care upon his sons. His heart is no more his, nor his thoughts with him. Only he is there, scorned of his neighbors. Yea, his portion is gall to the brim, and wormwood is the morsel now for him. For in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. And after, he is as one dead. Happy the man who deems his own part that of a stranger who is quickly fled, who has no contemplation in his heart, nor thought, nor sense, but his soul's afterlife and recompense. Yet in the end he shall return, as at his birth he was, so shall he be. Rabbi Ben Ezra, the real Rabbi Ben Ezra, was not guilty of the romantic nonsense of Robert Browning. Grow old with me, the best is yet to be. And our tradition knows little of that romantic innocence which closes its eyes to all the deformities of age. Look at the Bible. Isaac becomes blind with age. Our father Jacob becomes a doting fool who chooses out one son who pleases him and pushes off the rest. The high priest Eli, we're told, became so infirm and so corpulent in age that one day when he was presiding at a great public festival, his throne tipped over backwards and he fell down and he broke his neck. And King David became so cold with age that the only way he could be kept warm alive was from the warmth of other bodies who had been placed in bed beside him. When King Saul wanted the king of Gilead to make war with him against the Philistines, the king of Gilead returned to him a letter which bespeaks many of the infirmities of age. He says, in essence, no thank you, I can't take up arms again. I am a man now of 80 years. And I no longer can make clear decisions. I no longer taste the food or the drink that's given to me. I no longer can hear the poets or the chorus in the court when they sing. I no longer can move about with any agility. I simply cannot help you. The Bible has very few illusions about age. And if you want to cap it all and sum it all up, turn to the very last chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes. Remember then thy Creator in the days of thy youth, before the evil days come, when you shall say, I have no pleasure in them. Whatever age is or is not, it is a time when the pleasures of youth cannot be enjoyed again. You can't climb the mountains. You can't ski down the slopes. It's a time when the pleasures of maturity are to a certain degree denied you. You can't move with the same ease and vigor. There's pain. You can't think with the same speed. Your mind does slow down. You worry about yourself. And most of all, I suspect, you worry about becoming dependent upon some other self. Ourselves. Many men have drawn the comparison between aging and childhood. We call it the second childhood. The child moves from dependence to independence. And as we age, we move from independence back towards dependence. The child moves from affection and from a sense of a pleasure which comes from sharing to the sexual drives and love. And as we age, we move from the sexual appetites back towards affection, companionship, the need to belong and to be protected. The child thinks concretely. He does not yet make the adjustment between events. He does not think conceptually. As we move into adulthood, we learn to put things together, to see in concepts. And as we age, the linkage opens up again. It's very difficult to see how things relate, to think new thoughts. And we begin to think and talk anecdotally rather than conceptually. When we're young, our appetites grow. We have to learn to discipline them. When we age, our appetites diminish. And we have to force ourselves sometimes to eat, to take care of ourselves, to keep clean. It's not easy to age. And a person who does so with dignity, with a sense of purpose, is a person who commands and should command our greatest respect. One of the great fallacies of modern times is that we prepare ourselves for all the stages of life except age. One of the great revolutions in the development of human personality has been that over the last generation or two, we've taken the time of instruction for the young from their first 12 years. We've extended it through college and graduate school. We have to prepare ourselves at great length and with great diligence for life. And yet most of us fail to prepare for age with even the kind of diligence we would prepare for a three-week trip abroad. Our society insists that there's a time that we're going to retire. And very often, because our society likes to have clean lines, there's a day when we hit 62 or 65 when we must retire. And people know that, decades ahead. But they live to that very last day as if it will never happen. They assume that you can make the transference from full maturity, productive maturity, to retirement overnight. And as a result, the 6 months after retirement are one of the most dangerous of all periods in our lives. The mortality rate shoots up sky high. Suddenly, time hangs heavy on our hands. Suddenly, we feel we're being cast out. We don't know how to handle the feelings. We don't know how to fill our days. And we commit, in a sense, a kind of spiritual suicide. I don't know why we refuse to prepare ourselves for aging. In part, I suppose, it's because for very few of us, until the last generation or two, age was really a possibility. Men and women died simply too young. You didn't have to worry about it. But today, there's no excuse for the lack of preparation for aging. We know very little about it, most of us. We make few preparations for that time when we cannot continue doing just those things we have been doing. For most of us, allow our lives to be defined entirely by the work that we do. And when the door is shut to our office and we're not allowed to come in again, we have nothing. Now, our women heretofore have been better prepared for age than the men, because we did not allow them to define themselves by profession, by business, by that kind of work. They were defined by family. And family goes on. And when the responsibilities of motherhood end, then there's a volunteer work in the community. And when this tends to diminish their grandchildren to take care of, or there's someone who's invalid in our family, there's always family work to be done. And so our women lived longer, not only because they had greater biological strength, but because in a sense they were prepared by life for age, but not the men. And I suspect that in the generation when the working women begin to show up in great numbers at 62 and 65, they're going to have to face the same problems of readjustment that most men must face when they reach that time. The statistics would indicate that we'd better begin while we're in the full strength of our powers to develop other skills, other interests, other activities, things which can engage us and fill our time. Emptiness is killing and destructive. It's hard to prepare for age, but you know, if you live to be 70, you can expect to live 12 more years. And if you live to be 80, you can expect to live 8 more years. That's a long time. And during that period of time, you know that certain things are going to happen to you because it happens to everyone. Yes, at a different pace to everyone, but it happens nonetheless. A lot of people who want to romanticize age point to the fact that Winston Churchill became Prime Minister of England at the age of 66. And we can draw from our more immediate example, Picasso was still painting in his high 80s. Casals was still giving concerts in his early 90s. These are the exceptions, not the rule. Some, by virtue of great vigor or great strength or for whatever reason, delay longer than others in moving down the slow path of age. But they move down that path nevertheless. For a long time, experience can mask the deterioration of some of our mental processes. But if we test these processes with an intelligence test, at 45, you're not going to measure as high as at 25. And at 65, you're not going to measure as high as at 45. And at 85, you're not going to measure as high as any time before. Statistically clear, the evidence is there. Now, when we age, we seem to pass through three processes. The first, the doctors call aging, slowing down. We still are mobile, competent, able, but we get tired more easily. We tend to be a little more conservative in our actions and in our reactions, a little more certain about our conclusions, a little more intolerant of what others say. We don't quite see as well, we don't quite hear as easily, but we're fully competent to operate as human beings. And then gradually, age gives way to senescence. And senescence is the time when we become increasingly dependent upon others. We need help moving about. We need help in terms of care, personal care. We need help in terms of seeing to it that we keep a balanced diet, that we do the things which we need to do to keep us alive. And after senescence, there's senility. When our mind, in a sense, blanks out, when we cease to be competent, in the legal sense of the word, able to independently, through our own judgment and wisdom, manage and govern our actions. Now, of all the ages of life, I suppose that old age gives us the least opportunity for joy, pleasure unbounded, probably because we still look at joy and pleasure unbounded in terms of youth and not in the terms appropriate to our time. If all your life you have lived alone, proud of your competence involved in yourself, you suddenly can't change, develop the gentle arts of friendship, and find pleasure in people whom you've put down, not to their face, but in your own mind, all of your life. And if all of your life you've been contemptuous of the ties of family, you don't want to be rooted, to be tied down, you want to be independent, you suddenly at 75 or 80 or 85 cannot turn back to family to find there the joys of family love. You know that wonderful fairy tale of the Grimm brothers? It's a grim story, but it makes its point. A father, grandfather, up in his years, ate in a very unbecoming way at the dinner table. His food slobbered through out of his mouth. And finally, the farmer, his son, threw together some planks and built him a little trough so he would eat away from the family table. And one day, the farmer saw his son with a hammer and nails and saw and some wood. And he said, "Young man, what are you doing?" And the son answered, "I'm building for you a trough for when you get old." As we live in respect to our family, so we can expect from them when we age. Parents who have driven their children away cannot expect that when they are cantankerous and difficult and need help, that the child will always freely and easily return to them a love which they did not find expressed in earlier years. It's not easy to grow old, but there are joys. The joy of being free from certain kinds of pressure. The joys of an opportunity to walk out into a larger world than the world of home and office and responsibility. But here again, you've got to be prepared to walk into that larger world while you're still able to develop the skills. If you've been blind to art all of your life, never bothered to read, never bothered really to look, you won't suddenly get pleasure by walking into an art museum. And if you have no hobbies, and have had nothing to do except to read the stock tables and your business report, you won't suddenly find pleasure in painting or in music or reading or what have you. And among those for whom old age is not an immediate financial problem, and it is a pressing financial problem for most, but among those who are the fortunate 2%, if they are not prepared for age, they generally find that their lives involve an endless round of cards, of travel, of overly stuffed dinners, from which they increasingly derive less pleasure. If you have not developed the art of conversation, if you've not made yourself an interesting person when you're 20 and 30 and 40, how are you suddenly going to become interesting to others when you're 70 and 80? If there's nothing here, what can come out here? Aging, if we're lucky enough to live to retirement and beyond, requires preparation, just like growing up. How many people have ever sat down and worked out an elementary school, high school, college program of preparation for aging? Every one of us acts as if it's simply going to happen. It'll be natural. We'll know how to do it. Well, you won't know how to do it. You can't. No one can understand really what it means to have the body balk, not do what we want it to do. None of us can predict just what degenerative diseases will take what pace in our frame when it comes our time. None of us can predict who will be with us of those who are closest, when we find ourselves alone? How many of us have ever really sat down and thought through just what age involves and how we're going to cope with it? Yes, on one level we do, or we try to, in terms of providing some financial wherewithal. And it's rarely enough, except in that tiny band of people who are fairly wealthy. And obviously in America, one of the crying needs is for some kind of welfare program which can truly take care of the financial and the health needs of the aging and of the elderly. But that aside for the moment, that aside, I see elderly people who know very little about aging, who suddenly decide that the future lies in a better climate than Cleveland. Now, God knows I'd be the last person to proclaim the virtues of Cleveland's climate. But one thing we do know about age is that age requires roots. It requires a familiar frame. And if without preparation you suddenly at 75 or 80 pull yourself up and put yourself down in Sun Village, USA, what happens? You're disoriented. You're among people who are of your age, but who have their own problems, and very little time for yours. You're suddenly cut off from your family. Now, it's possible to make this adjustment if there's very little keeping you home, if you're the kind of person who still has the mental energy to accomplish it. But all of us know of those who have gone south and come back north, and who have paid an emotional price. And how many of us have really thought through the question of how we will accept institutionalization when that time comes? For most of us, the fear of an institution, however well managed, and many of them are magnificently managed, is not the fear of the institution, but that we will somehow lose our roots, our apartment, the familiar, the surroundings which prove to us every day that we're still us, ourselves. Many old folks' homes, in quotation marks, terrible word, many of these institutions, you know, encourage people to bring with them their furniture, so that there will be some kind of tangible, visible evidence that we're still ourselves and in our own world. But what if this can't be done? Have we who are aging, have those who are aging really thought through and prepared themselves emotionally for the time when this kind of change must take place? Or are we going to find subtle ways to throw up at our children the fact that they must somehow bear the guilt for calling us every morning and every night to make sure that we're in and safe and taking care of ourselves? A task that many of them may be unable to discharge. You have to prepare yourself emotionally, spiritually, as well as physically for age. And how many of us have talked over with our children what we really feel about age? Whether we feel that there's a time when we would find life too much. Because if that time comes, we're not going to be able to make the decision. We'll be suffering from pneumonia, disease, and the doctor whose job it is to heal doesn't want to take this responsibility on himself, not to do certain things, to take certain heroic measures. And he'll turn to our children. And how can they respond? What will the training of and the love of 50, 60 years mean? Can they say, don't do for dad, for mother? Well, they can only if we've allowed them to make that kind of decision. If we've been honest with them and talked over with them, as well as with our doctor, what we truly feel about paralysis and age. Most parents and most children do not talk about age except to complain about it. To complain that one isn't paying enough attention to the other, or the other is being too difficult, too imperious, too demanding of the younger generation. But we've got to talk about age with those who are nearest and closest, because increasingly we are dependent on them, not only for physical support, but for judgment. And they have to know a little bit of how we feel and what our reactions are. Yes, you can live too long, but I'm afraid today that that's only part of the problem. And the larger problem is that for many, living too long is simply a tribute to their not having been prepared for a rich gift from God. They find themselves in these years of semi-retirement and retirement, of aging, with time on their hands, still able, still capable, still energetic. God's been good to them. And they haven't been good to themselves, because they're not prepared. There are no interests. There's no involvement. Nothing but participation in an increasingly small group of friends who do the same things week in and week out and wonder whose funeral they're going to go to next. Now, preparation for age as well as preparation for adulthood is a very private thing. Some children are verbally talented and some are not. Some have great artistic talents and some do not. Some are very ordinary and some are very special. And that's true of all adults. So the preparation that each of us must make for age is a very special thing. For some of us, it means the development of our own unique talents. We have a good eye, we have a good hand. For some of us, it means the development of the respect that we've earned in our community and to the use of that respect in ways which will allow us to serve on voluntary boards in a service capacity. For some of us, it means a chance to serve others, to take the time to be with, because those who are busy 18 hours a day don't have the time to do it. Now there's the time to work with the young. Now there's the time to work with the aged. Now there's the time to work with the handicapped, the ill, the lonely. If in a community such as ours of 2.5 million people, you're still active and you're still able and you can't find anything to do, I really have very little pity for you. There's so much that can be done. There's so many places to go to which need help, which need your time and your energy. And the energy, the initiative has to come from you. Nobody's going to go out and say, you know, we need just you. There's a time to be born, and there's a time to die. In time, our energies run out. Our body ceases to reproduce its cells. It ceases to renew itself. But between aging and senility, it's a long period of time. It's a period of great opportunity to find out new things about yourself, to express yourself in new and pleasurable ways, to find fulfillment in a series of quiet joys that you didn't give yourself a chance to feel up till now, to have a relationship of friendship and a family which involves the kind of time that you couldn't give to it till now, to enjoy certain hobbies, certain sports, certain activities that you couldn't do to this point, to develop new skills. Why not use it? Why not take full advantage of it? Why not prepare yourself for it? And all the while recognize what's happening to you in the process of aging. The things that you cannot do any longer. Don't be frustrated by that. It happens to everyone. But for every loss, there's some gain, if you can discover it. Find out what it is. And take the time to know yourself, to expose yourself to this opportunity, and to live by it. In the end, we all die. In the end, our energies run out. Blessed indeed is the man who uses the twilight years fully well. Blessed indeed is the woman who fills the time of the sunset with opportunity.